Hi everyone, I'm Robin. And I am so excited to be here today. I am just having the time of my life at your convention, and I want to thank all of the people involved in putting this together, and all of you who obviously successfully got around the marathon to find your way here this morning. You know, you're the winners. And I'm grateful. Betty, thank you for putting on a wonderful event for all of us. And I really appreciate that. Your training did amazing. And Patrick. Oh my God, Patrick. You are the bomb. I mean, this man has hosted us in a way that I have never hosted someone. That every single thing has been taken care of. And I am so grateful for that. Thank you so much. And then to the people of my heart, you know, my sponsor, Lorene, who was your luncheon speaker yesterday, is just something that touches me in a way that I hope you have that with your sponsor. And I'm so grateful that she got to be here and her husband, Lynn, this weekend. And see, I mentioned you, huh? $2. And, and you know something, as a result of being of service in this program, I have the opportunity to meet people I wouldn't get to spend time at meetings with. And one of those people that's very near and dear to me is my friend Lynn. Lynn and I go back many years in much, much service in this program, many years on convention work, whether it be AFG or SoCal or a fundraiser, and her husband Bruce. And I love you guys. And see, I wouldn't get any of that. This is the gift that I didn't think I wanted or needed when I came into this program. And it's what sustains me today. So I hope those of you who came here with thinking this was going to be a spiritual meeting, please lower your expectations a little bit right now. Because I'm just trying not to be potty mouth, okay? So that's about as spiritual as I try to be. And if that works for you, hey, we're going to be good. You know, for me, the spiritual experience is a culminative of what's gone on this entire weekend. You know, I got to hear Grace on Friday night, and that was amazing. You know, thank you. And then last night to hear Bruce and Jita and Ginger. I mean, how wonderful is that? New friends, new faces, new people I can't wait to see again. And, of course, my sponsor, you know, being your luncheon speaker. And then right after this, Jimmy Dean will be there for you. We can't wait to hear you speak. And you know what? That's what we do, is we support each other in this program. And I don't have any answers of Al-Anon, and I'm not going to be able to explain Al-Anon to you. I'm just going to tell you my experience, strength, and hope. If in hearing that it does something for you, well, that's great. But it's just my experience, strength, and hope. And I don't know about you or any of you that are new or fairly new, and I first also want to say, if you're here and you're a double winner or you're from AA and you've chosen to come in here today, thank you. Thank you for supporting our program, and thank you for allowing people like me into your open meetings to hear firsthand from you that it wasn't about me. You didn't want this disease. You didn't choose it. You weren't given a checklist of what disease do you want. You said, oh, alcoholism, that sounds good, and I know that now. And I know I was not the target, and I know that you didn't intentionally want to hurt anybody. No one takes a drink from what you've told me to hurt somebody else. It's a disease. And I am grateful that you allow people like me into your open meetings so that I can hear that and I can learn from that. So if you're here and you're from AA today, thank you for coming to support us, because you are part of the family disease, and we are too, and we walk in recovery together. So thank you for that. I don't know about you guys, but when I came into this program, I was looking for reasons I didn't need to stay. So I had my little checklist in my mind, and I was going by the three strikes, you're out. So I was believing that if there were three strikes, then I didn't have to stay here. I didn't want to belong. I'll get to why I was here later, but it certainly was not the reason I should have had. So I sat in my meetings, and you know, I kept hearing Al-Anon say, now, they may have not said this all the time, but you know how we are. You hear it once and you think, oh, I always heard. You know, you heard it once, but that's just me. That's my disease. As I came from an alcoholic home, and I didn't. I came from the home you want to come from. I was raised in a beautiful environment. I had very loving parents, and thank you, God, they're still alive. And I had a wonderful experience growing up. I had a lot of amenities that I just thought everybody had. I had the opportunity to grow up in Europe. I lived in Greece for many years, and I grew up there, and I went to school there, and I had wonderful schools I went to there and wonderful opportunities. I am not bragging. I just thought this was normal. You know, we traveled to other countries. My father had a job that was kind of interesting, and they weren't alcoholic. And there was drinking in our home, but very little. In fact, we were talking the other night, and I think my father's 85 now, and I think in his life he's had maybe two or three beers, maybe. And I don't even know if he finished them. We did not have active drinking. So I just thought everybody got to do these type of things. We came back to the United States, and I was in high school, and I lived in Connecticut. And we were living in a place where there were schools that were, I went to a public school for eighth grade. After eighth grade, a lot of my friends transitioned to this really nice private prep school. Well, I didn't take the entrance exams. I didn't sit for the interviews for it. I didn't do any of that. And it was a very expensive school. Now, even though we had all of these nice opportunities, my parents were not wealthy. We just had lots of nice opportunities. Thank you, U.S. government. My father was a CIA agent, so there you go. He's 85. He doesn't even remember it now. The secrets are safe. I'm lucky he knows me. So anyway, we came back, and all my friends went ninth grade. A lot of them went to this school, and I didn't. And I had a counselor, and you know something, as a result of this program, and really looking at my life, and the opportunities given to me, and the people that were my angels, and I didn't even know it then, now I can look back and say, wow, that was super cool. And I had this counselor, and I don't know why I was in his office. I didn't do anything bad, because God knows my father would have investigated me, so we were real straight and narrow kind of kids. And I was talking to him about something, and he said, you know, Robin, you should have gone to this other school. And I said, well, I didn't sit for the exam. There was interviews. There was a lot of money involved. And he said, but you really need to be there. And I said, well, and he said, let me make a phone call. Now, my parents are not involved at this level. You know, I am just in the eighth, ninth grade. And he made a call to the school, and he talked to the principal there. And they set up an interview that day for me. And I went over and I interviewed with the principal, a very nice man, very kind man. And he said, do you want to start Monday? I mean, where does that come from? What a gift. My parents didn't feel exactly the same because I went home and told them, guess where I'm going Monday? And they were like, oh, my God. And you know something? My parents, being the loving people that they were, they are, my mom went out and got a job. And I went to that school. Now, it was a prep school, and being in Connecticut, it was kind of prepping you supposedly for Harvard or Yale, neither of which that I ever want to go to. I just wanted to meet the shiny him and go off and, you know, and have a nice life. I really had no intention of going to school other than to have fun. And but I went to the school, and it was a great school, and it gave me a good education. And when I was going into my junior year of school, my father was getting transferred, and it was going to be where he was going to retire. And so my parents wanted South Carolina. They wanted Myrtle Beach. I have no idea why. We had never been to Myrtle Beach, but they wanted Myrtle Beach, and I didn't, you know, because I'm so important, right? I make the decisions in the house. I'm a whopping, I don't know, 14, 15 years old, and I'm thinking, no, I don't want to go to Myrtle Beach. I want to go to California. You know, because that's fun. I heard the Beach Boys music, and I was going to California. And they said, no, that's not an option. Our options were, I don't remember, Myrtle Beach was one of them, and something was somewhere else equally as unacceptable to me. And so my father came home one day, and he said, okay, we got the orders. And I said, oh, dear. And he said, we're going to California. And we came to Southern California. And what was interesting is we hit California, and coming from Connecticut, and Connecticut is just not exactly the same as Southern California, it is a lot wilder out here. Now, I'm not allowed to be wild, and I'm a real rule follower. I still am. You tell me turn left, I turn left, even if I'm going into a tree, because you told me to turn left, and I am a rule follower. So we came to Southern California, and my parents bought a home because my father was retiring. And we bought a home in Huntington Beach, California. And I went to Huntington Beach High School. And I loved Huntington Beach High School. This was a very long time ago, when, you know, and it was real, and I'm sure it still is. I don't know. I don't live there now. But it was a nice place for me to finish up high school. When I was a senior in high school, I met him. We know who the first hymns are. We know. He was a very nice young man. I guess you can call him a man. My God, we're 17 years old. I mean, really? You know, he was very kind to me. He was very, very nice, kind, sweet, attentive, not abusive. So I had to dump him, because why would you want that, you know? And so we went together for a couple years. And you know something? In retrospect, I had no appreciation for that gift of that young man. Absolutely a gift that, in a lot of ways, I have never had again. And, you know, and he was totally dedicated to me. I was not to him. I have been ever since, but not then. And what I did in walking away from that relationship, I gave him the opportunity, without knowing it, to find the love of his life and to have the life he deserved. And it was not with me. And to the best of my knowledge, because I don't stalk people, maybe a little, okay, but not a lot. My father taught me well. He lives in Oregon with his wife, and they are very happy and have been for many, many years now. And for that, I am grateful. I had an opportunity not too many years ago to kind of connect with him, and it was purely innocent. We had a mutual friend that passed away from high school. And for some reason, on Facebook, I got the message. And it freaked me out, because I thought, this is a scam. This is a scam. And so I reached out to some of that guy's friends on Facebook and said, I'm getting this message. Did he really die? And he responded and said, yes, he did. And I said, I'm sorry. And then he messaged me a couple of things, and I said, I just want you to know I'm sorry for so much. And he said, it's all good. And that's the last contact we've had, and that's fine. That was the amends God wanted me to make. It wasn't track him down, get in front of him, try and look pretty and shiny. And no, it was just a simple, I'm sorry, and a heartfelt sorry, and not trying to disrupt or insert myself into someone's life. So because our amends step talks about making amends, except when to do so will injure them or others. He has a wife. He has a family. He is happy. To insert myself in there just to say, I'm sorry, and to dance around a little bit would not be in a heartfelt amends. That would be something else I need to make amends for, and my list is too long as it is, so I'm going to try and keep it shorter. So having said that, I went to school. I did go to college. It was a junior college, because, again, I have no intention of getting any kind of degree that I can make a living at. I just want to find the next pretty cute him. And I did. I did. I did it very quickly. I was working, and he walked in. Now, this he is a lot different from the other he. He is a lot different than the other he. See, I didn't owe you a dollar. I didn't say it. And he walked in, and he was good looking. I mean, he was good looking. And he was wearing the right clothes, and he had this wonderful car, and he had this wonderful job. And he was older than me, and I liked him a lot. And we went out on a date, and you know, there were so many red flags, it's ridiculous. I could have been hit in the head with a red flag and not seen it, because I'm so stupid. I think I'm mature, but I'm 17, I mean, you know. I think I was 18 at that time. So I'm 18, and we go out on a date, and he takes me. I'm an 18-year-old, and he's, I don't know how old, he's 8 years older than me, I think. And we go to a bar, and he orders a drink. Now, what am I supposed to order? I'm 18, so I had to think of a sophisticated drink. And the best sophisticated drink I could come up with at 18 was ginger ale. So I got ginger ale with twist of lime. You know, because I'm cool. I'm 18. Okay, so on the way back from that date, there was a girl that pulled up next to us in a car, and I guess she was good looking, and he made me duck because I wasn't pretty enough. So that was the man that I had target to marry, because, you know, who wouldn't want to marry someone who treats you like that, right? So here we are. I'm 18 years old. He's got me ducking in a car because I'm not pretty enough. And we continued to date. He continued to drink. The equation, nothing matched up for me, because I have no connection with alcoholism at this point. Well, at that point, yes, I did. I did not know it. So we were out to dinner one night in Laguna Beach, and he was drunk. I was not, because, you know, I'm 18. I'm drinking those ginger ales. I am so bubbled up. I can't believe it. I am carbonated. And I'm drinking those ginger ales. And he said, let's play a joke on your mom and dad. Now, I don't know why why? I mean, first of all, the question should have been why, but it wasn't. I said, okay, because, you know, I'm trying to, you know, impress this guy. And we'd been dating, a long time, 2 weeks maybe. And he said, let's tell them that we're getting married. Now, I don't know why I thought that, you know, and I'm giggling like it's going to be so funny. And inside I'm thinking, what the flippity doodah, again, didn't say it. What the flippity doodah are we saying that for? Why would we want to say that? So, but what came out was, oh my gosh, okay. So we went back to my house in Huntington Beach, and my mom came out in the kitchen, and he said, guess what? And I thought, oh God, who knows what he's going to say? And he told her we're getting married. And she was like, oh my God, you know, but he was shiny, nice, good, you know, job. And my father was never happy with the high school boyfriend because he was never going to amount to anything in his mind, which, by the way, he did. And then, but he thought this one had a better job, which, anyway, so I'm sitting there waiting for the punchline. We're going to tell mom and dad, it's just a joke. And so a month later, we got married, just to really give it a punchline. And we got married. I mean, I'm 18 years old. I got married to a man I had no idea about. I had no idea. We didn't have any of those talks that might be important, like, do you ever want children? I mean, nothing. We knew nothing about each other. Evidently, he came from a family that that was very popular in the world. And I showed up at my wedding, and the National Enquirer was there taking pictures. Now, I had no idea, because that shows you how much I knew about him. We had a beautiful wedding. My parents, you know, made it happen. And we came home after the wedding that night. He was been drinking, and shocking, I think I actually had a glass of champagne. I'm not ratting myself out. I was 18 still, but almost 19, and I thought that qualified me. And so I had. He got home that night, and he beat me up. And that began my connection with this disease and how I react to it. That was what I did from that point on, is how the disease affected me and what I did and how I reacted to it. And what I do when I'm scared and I don't know how to explain things, I find I isolate. I build a wall between you and me, because I think I need to stay in my little wall and figure it out before I can ask for help. My parents were very loving and kind. They would have done anything and still would for me. Well, my father wouldn't remember it, but he would if he could. And but I didn't have the guts to tell them. So the next day when they came over, we're opening presents. How's it go? Oh, good. Again, I am starting what will become for me my worst shortcoming, and that is lying. More, not so much lying to you as it's lying to me. I kept saying, I'm okay. I wasn't okay. I was confused, I was scared, and I didn't know what I had done, and I wanted mommy and daddy to save me, but I felt like, you made your bed, Robin, you got it now, make it work. And in my very immature mind, I thought, if I act more like mom, he will act more like dad. So I set out to try and emulate my mother, you know, cooking these certain meals, house was super clean, and then he'll act more like dad. Dad never beat mom, and it never happened like that. And I found myself locking myself in bathrooms a lot, because back then it was the only room in the house that locked, and I felt safe, and I would go in there until, I used to say, he went to sleep. He didn't go to sleep. He'd pass out, and then I'd come out. And I'd sit on the couch by myself. And we know I'm a pretty social person, and my family was too. We always had people at our home. We couldn't do that, because that's what the disease does for me, is it robs me of my hope, my joy, my love, my expectations, my wonderful expectations of the future, the good things, the dreams that you have. The disease takes that away from me, and I give it willingly. So what I do is I isolate. And I was in those bathrooms by myself. And there's not a lot that goes on in there. And I would read those romantic novels, you know, and dream of the day when, you know, he is going to come in. I don't know what I expected him to do, knock down the bathroom door and find me. But, you know, because I'm in there by myself. And I lasted in that marriage for about 4 years. I never told my parents what was going on. But one time we were on our way to a wedding reception. And I don't remember what happened. We were going down the freeway. We got into a little scuffle, and he went to hit me, and I hit him back, and so he pushed me out of the car on the freeway. And I cut my chest up. He did slow down, like I had to give him credit for that. Oh, he slowed down, so it was okay. And he came back for me, so no harm, no foul. And I remember we went to the wedding reception, and my father was there. And that was the only time my father walked up to me, and he went to hug me, and he looked down, and my chest was cut, and he said, "I will kill him." And I knew my father meant it, because my father could and would and probably has. And I thought, oh, my God. So I said, oh, no, 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 no. You know, we got to lie, because that's what I have to do. I have to lie to you about what's going on in my life so I can live it. Because if I tell you the truth of my life, you're going to know, and you're going to look at me in my mind like, what the heck is wrong with you, Robin? Why can't you live in a way that will make this all better? And I didn't know how, because I have no experience of this. So eventually, 4 years later, we get a divorce. And I called my parents had actually gotten a divorce at that time. And but they were, it was just like friends parting. It really, truly was. And they were still very friendly until, to this day, they still are. And I called my mom and dad at work. Now, this was before cell phones. And I called my going-to-be ex-husband to make sure he was at work, because that was an hour and a half away. So I knew I had an hour and a half. And I called my dad and I said, I'm leaving. And my father didn't even ask what happened. He said, I'll be right there with the trailer. And he did. Mom and dad pulled up, and things were coming out of that house so quick into that trailer. And I remember at one point, my father said, where are you going to go? And I said, I don't know. And before my mother could, of course, move me into her little condo, my dad had a few homes, and he said, you're going to one of mine. And he put me there, and that was it. And I'll tell you what, I never looked back. I never wanted to reconcile. I never wanted to talk about it, because I was so done and so hurt, and I knew I needed to heal. I knew I needed time to grow up, because I think at that time, I'm 22 at that time. And I'm very mature now. I'm 22, and I don't want to date. I don't want to do anything. I'm just going to, you know, heal. So I waited a week before I went out on my first date. I had to heal. And my first date was another him. But this was a better him, because it was someone I worked with, so I'd done a little background check on that. You know, I knew his last name. And so he asked me out to a Dodger game. Seemed fair enough, okay, Dodger game. We went out, and we ate peanuts and popcorn and drank soda. Nobody was drunk. And I thought, wow, this is refreshingly good. Now, I have not heard the word alcoholism, and I have not equated to this point what happened to me in that first relationship with anything to do with alcoholism. See, in my little immature mind, I'm still thinking, if I act like mom, he'll act like dad. I failed, my fault. So now I'm in this new relationship. Yeah, we're on our first date. And, you know, I really liked this guy. He was funny. I didn't get hit. He was nice. He was a little sarcastic, but it was kind of funny. And so I decided by the third inning that I was going to marry him. And I would explain this to him on the way home and that night. Well, it didn't exactly go that way, because he started telling me a little bit about his life. And at that time, he said to me, he shared that he was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he had 2 years at that time. And that Alcoholics Anonymous and the God of his understanding needed to be the first thing in his life so that he could have a life. Well, I thought, that's probably very true, because you've not met me, but you've got me now, and we don't need this. And, I mean, why do you need this? I'm here. Because I've done such a bang-up job so far in my life in marriage. So, I mean, why would you not want me to be in charge? So he didn't go for that. And he kept going to his meetings. And he said he had to go to these meetings. Well, I didn't understand this, because I know how to be in a relationship or not in a relationship at all. I don't know how to be not in a relationship very long. But when I'm not in a relationship, I know I'm not in a relationship. Oh, I can out-talk this train. It's no problem. It's got nothing on me. So anyway, he's going to these meetings, and I'm not liking this because, you know, those nights he goes to meetings, which were Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, were a little boring for me. And I got a call when he got home because, you know, the meeting after the meeting, thank you, Lynn, would be like 11 o'clock at night because, you know, they got to talk in the parking lot. And I am dead tired, but I'm awake. And I'm acting like, oh, no problem, hi. And I'm thinking, where the hell? Oh, heck, almost. Where the heck is he? So one week he said to me, you know, would you like to go to an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with me on Friday night at the 502 Club in Covina? And my mind said, why would I want to do that? No. But my mouth said, oh my gosh, that'd be wonderful. And so I got ready. I had no idea what to expect. I didn't know what this program was about. I didn't know what you were all about. I just knew that I'd gone from being in a bathroom by myself to being at home in this home by myself. And this by myself thing is not my favorite thing to do because it's me, myself, and I, and we don't get along. And so I thought, okay, let's go. So I walk into the 502 Club. Now, I don't know if any of you have ever been to the 502 Club in Covina. It's a real hot spot. So it's an industrial center, and there's this meeting room, and they have very low ceilings, and it can comfortably probably hold 150. I think there was 300 people in there, and they were all smoking. And I thought, oh, my God. But they had a no-smoking sign, which to this day cracks me up. Why, folks? Really? Just take a breath. We're all smokers. And so I walked in there, and you scared me. Because you have to remember, at that point, I have come from a place where I have spent 4 years of my life, the last 4 years of my life in a bathroom by myself, scared, confused, and trying to build a wall up to keep you out, to understand what's going on in here. My wall is big, and it is solid at that point. And I walked in wall first, and you guys were all in there. And you were in there, and what you had scared me. Because when I presented to this program, and this, I do not consider this my time in Al-Anon, because I was in an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not an alcoholic. So until I get to Al-Anon, I don't consider that when I came into program. But I walked into that meeting wall first, and I saw lights on in your eyes. I saw you laughing. And you see, the only thing I gave you at that point was one feeling. There was only one feeling I had, and that was numb. I was numb to everything. I had to become numb to survive. I had to just be devoid of all feelings in order to survive. So I walked into that room, and the smoke and the lights on in your eyes, and you were hugging and touching, and there wasn't a lot of hugging and touching going on in my bathroom, so this is kind of new to me. And you ran up to me and made big bear hugs, and I'm thinking, oh my God. And then, you know, I'm watching him, and he's getting a lot of bear hugs, and I'm thinking, and I'm taking note of which AA women are doing that, so we can talk on the way home. And then I sat down, and I was scared, and you started talking, and the sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous that shared touched my heart. And all after a few weeks, I was looking forward to going to the meeting. It wasn't so much about him, it was you. I wanted to connect with you. And at one meeting, my new best friend, Lorene, came up to me, and I walked in, and she took my hand, and she said, "Hi, Robin." I wanted to cry because no one knew my name. No one had done, I had no connection. I had no friends at that point. The disease takes everything away so that it can be in control for me. And she walked up and she said, "I saved you a seat." She saved me a seat. This is my new best friend in my mind. I thought, oh my God, someone knew my name. They saved me a seat. I was worthy. That's what this program has given me. The self-esteem that I so generously gave to the disease was giving it back to me. The program, the recovery, all of you were giving it back to me slowly and beautifully. And I sat in that meeting week after week, and I enjoyed it, and I looked forward to it. One night, Lorene did say something very offensive to me. She said, "Would you like to go to Al-Anon?" And I thought, why? Why? I'm perfectly fine here. But he had not asked me to marry him yet. Now, I got this time schedule thing going on, and he has not dropped to a knee and decided I am the love of his life, or certainly his higher power. And so I thought, okay, I'll go to this Al-Anon thing. Maybe they'll teach me the slogan that I need to go home and go, blah, 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 live, live, live and let live, let go and let God. And he'll go, "You're it," and we'll get married. So I thought, okay, Al-Anon's got the answer. So she said, there's a meeting next door. I don't remember the days. I pulled up there on a Thursday night, and I sat, the 502 Club, it's all glass on the side in the parking lot, and I pulled my car in early because I'm a rule follower. You tell me be there early, I'm early. I could be 2 days early, but I'll be early. And so I'm sitting there, and I watched the people going in, and I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. You scared me. I was at tears sitting in the front seat of my car, and I watched that meeting for an hour and a half. And I sat there and I watched the meeting after the meeting in the parking lot. I couldn't go in. So I went home. The next Monday, I went back and I walked into that meeting. And that was November 9th of 1983. And I've not left Al-Anon since then. You guys have been as good as your word, although I thought a lot of what you were telling me was a bunch of baloney. See, I said the baloney word. That was pretty good. Anyway, I really didn't believe it. But I started hearing things that I wanted to believe. I wanted to have, when I first went into, I never smoked, but they smoked in these meetings. And I remember this one lady, Marie, she had the big Marge Simpson hair that was blue mostly. And she had a big cigarette in her mouth, and she was always crocheting. And she'd have that big cigarette hanging out with the big ash. And I was always watching it going up and down as she talked. I was waiting for that ash to drop. Anyway, and she said to me, honey, if you want what we got. And I thought, oh, my God. No. I'm 22, folks. I'm hoping this is not. And so I don't. But I stayed because what Marie had that I didn't have was a life she enjoyed living. And I didn't have that. And she had it because she worked steps and she showed up at meetings and she was honest about her feelings and whatever else she wanted to do. So I wanted what she had. And so I kept coming back. I did get a sponsor. I did work steps. Eventually, I did get married. I got them. Score. And we got married. We had a big program wedding. His sponsor had it at his house. It was beautiful. And now we're good. Now, what could go wrong now, folks? Look, we got AA program. We got Al-Anon program. We got lots of service work going on. And that was one of the things that was presented to me. I'm going to say presented. It was not optional. When I was in Covina, service was not optional. They would say really mean things to me, like, mark your seat, stay on your feet. Is that a newcomer? I don't know. Well, why don't you go find out? What's their name? Have you approached them yet? Stop isolating and extend yourself. Be the greeter at the door, Robin. Come with us. We're going to a convention. First year I went to the AFG convention was 1984, and it was at the Inn at the Park in Anaheim. It was a huge Al-Anon convention. And when I say huge, it was. It was about 2,000 or 3,000 people. And it was a big convention. And I walked in there, and I felt like the littlest fish in the big sea. And I wanted so much what you had. First of all, the first thing I wanted was somebody I recognized because I was so scared. But people would walk by me, and they would just hug me. Oh, hi. I thought, oh, my God, I just didn't want to leave. And the God of my understanding did for me exactly what I needed that year. So I'm glad that everyone else was there, but I really felt it was targeted at me because the two speakers that year, I will never, ever, ever forget, touched me in a way that hooked me in, and that was Elsa Chamberlain and Winnie Eddy. And those were the two speakers that year. And I sat there at table 60. Not that I have a resentment. I sat there at table 60 in the back, and I looked up at the podium, and I saw all the people sitting up on the dais. And I thought, one of these days, I want to be up there. Not because I wanted to be in charge, because in my mind at that point, that signified being a part of. And I loved you guys. I didn't know how to tell you, but I loved you. And I did want what you had. And in 2002, I got to be the chairman of that convention. And the interesting thing is, one of the things that I was given as a committee gift was a bookmark. It was a gold bookmark, and on the back, they had it engraved. And what they said has forever touched my heart. It said, dreams really do come true. And they had no idea that that was a dream coming true for me. And so that wasn't ego, that was a dream. I wanted to be a part of you, and I didn't know how to, and I wanted you to like me, and I would do anything. We did so much service work, well, some of it I really didn't want to. I mean, they told us mean things like shut up and get in the car. And I'm like, what? And where are we going? Does it matter? Yeah, it kind of does. I have this job tomorrow. Are we going to be back? You know? And I remember one time they took us to somewhere crazy. I don't even remember. I think it was Lawndale or something. And Mary Pearl was speaking there. And she was the speaker. They brought her out from Arkansas, and she was speaking. But she wasn't just speaking. It was an 8-hour pitch. And it had little breaks, thank God. And she was wonderful. I loved it. I never forgot it. But it was, you know, that's the shut up and get in the car. So if I'd have asked too many questions, I'd have bowed out and I would have missed the gift. So sometimes the service work for me has always connected the dots. It's always kept me connected to you on my worst day. And so, you know, being in Al-Anon, and I've got this husband in AA, and don't you know, it's all going to be grand, because what could go wrong with that, right? I've got a program. I'm going to meetings. I don't have any children. So I'm going to meetings Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, sometimes Sunday morning. And my sponsor at the time told me, because there was this thing going on at home. And it wasn't bad, and there was no alcoholism. I mean, well, there is a recovering alcoholic and a recovering Al-Anon, but there was no active drinking or anything like that. But what was happening is there was other isms going on that I didn't know how to address. Again, if I can't address it, I'm going to build a wall, and I'm going to keep you out because I need to be in here, and I don't know how to talk about it. Because just like that little girl before, I really believe that I need to figure it out. I've got this Al-Anon program. Why can't I figure out what's going on? And I found myself testing the waters when I went home. And I am not here to tell his story, but what I found myself doing is I would open the door after a meeting, and I'd go, hello, and I'd listen. And if I heard, oh, hi, oh, no, bad night, bad day. If I heard, hi, I'm upstairs, good day, go in. And that is the roller coaster that I placed myself on. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I don't like roller coasters. Roller coasters make me physically sick. Whether they be physical ones or emotional ones, I get sick. I don't like roller coasters. So if I told Lorene, if I ever call you and say, hi, I'm at Magic Mountain, that's code for I've been taken hostage to get here now, because you will not ever see me there. I do not like roller coasters. So, but I was riding one. And it wasn't his fault. It was his roller coaster, but I was the willing passenger. And I got on it, and we had good days and bad days, and good moments and bad moments. And sometimes it went from one moment to the next. We would be planning to go somewhere, and I'd put out socks for myself, and he'd go, oh, that's it. Are you wearing those socks? You know, that's it. F it. We're staying home. And I didn't know what I did wrong. Oh, that's it. We had to stay home. So that is what I started doing. So what do I do when I think, okay, I'm not working a good enough program. I'm not thinking ahead enough. I'm not laying out the right thing. I'm not making the right dinner. I got out of his way in the kitchen. And all of us, and he said one time, every time I come in a room, you leave. Now, I did not do that knowingly, but I was doing it because I knew I couldn't be around him. So when that's going on, you do the next best thing, which is have a child. And I got pregnant in, I got to get my time so I know. I don't keep you here all day. Ha! Anyway, so I got pregnant in, I don't know, 91 or something. No, it was before then, 87. But the reason I say that is because that was going to fix it. And late on in that pregnancy, I lost that baby in a bathroom by myself. You know, the bathroom for me is just, I don't know, I wish I'd have picked a better room to have my spiritual awakenings in, but apparently the bathroom is it. So I lost that baby. Now, when I lost that baby, for some reason in my mind, I believed that God was punishing me for something, and that was the punishment that I deserved. And so I kept that shame and that guilt, and I didn't share it. Now, when I know when I'm not being current with my sponsor or the people in this program that have the tools to remind me of what I can use and how I can be, how I need to work on myself, when I don't do that, I'm stagnant. So I don't care how much service work I was doing, I was stagnant. I was lying to you. How you doing, Robin? I'm fine. I'm okay. Oh, that's good. Go to another convention. Do another piece of service work. But I was dying inside, and I was ignoring it, and I'm lying to you. And then I went, in 1992, our son Zachary was born. And he is a blessing. Zachary is 32 years old now. And Zachary is, outside this program, when people ask me what my son does for a living, I tell him he's an author because he's writing his story. And that's what he's doing out there. He lives in a way that's unacceptable to live in my home. We have somewhat of a relationship today after years of not having a relationship. He lives with his father. Though I'll get to that part. And he lives with his father, and he lives in a way that's unacceptable to us. He's welcome there for limited times with conditions, and that's just the way it has to be. In 1994, my son Weston was born. And Weston is my little doll, my little angel. Is he perfect? Absolutely not. But I'll tell you what, he's a kind, compassionate man, and he's given me one of the biggest gifts of my life, and that's my granddaughter Lillian. And my little Lillian is 4 years old, and she has a meemaw that loves her. And I'm meemaw because she told me I'm meemaw. I'm not grandma, I am meemaw. And I love it, and that's a gift. That's a gift that you taught me how to appreciate and how to take care of. I don't kill the gift. I appreciate the gift and take care of it today, no matter what package it came in. It doesn't have the perfect little family, mother this, everything is not Ozzy and Harriet, but it's no less a gift. And in 1996, I was diagnosed with an aggressive form of cancer. And you know something? For years, I had been ignoring this, what I call the hole in my gut. Now, the hole in my gut started a long time ago with that roller coaster ride that I was on, but I ignored it. And remember, I've got this wall I'm building up, and though I'm being of service and I'm doing all this stuff, but I'm building that wall. And that hole in my gut doesn't get away, because you've taught me if you've got the hole, you've got to fill it. You can't fill it with just service work. You have to fill it with recovery and tools and steps and real work. And I wasn't willing to do that, because I have to tell someone what was going on so that we can do it together. I had several surgeries very quick. My last surgery, which was my big surgery, I was at this hospital. I was about, first of all, I have to tell my Betty Ann story, because I promised her I would, and I got to pay her $5 if I don't. So, before I had my big surgery, we were in Alathon, and someone called on me to share, and they said, we're going to have you share before you have your surgery. So I went up to share, and Betty Ann, and I'd never really met her before, and she came up to me, and she said, what surgery are you having? And I told her, and she said, well, where are you going to be? What hospital? And I said, well, I'll find out Tuesday, because I didn't know if I was going to be at City of Hope or if I was going to be at this other hospital. And she said, well, call me Tuesday and let me know. And I thought, yeah, right, like, you know me. You met me 30 seconds ago. So I said, but I did what I always do. Okay, sure. I didn't call her. Wednesday she called me. You didn't call me. That's this program for me. You said I care, and you did. And that I was not used to. And so there's my Betty Ann story. So I got kudos of $5. Anyway, so then I had the surgery. But that morning of my big surgery, I'm laying in intake, and I heard some people out there talking. And, you know, this program's always told me I'll never have to do anything alone again unless I choose to. And they're as good as their word. 17 women walked in there from my Monday night meeting. They drove. They had jobs. They had places to be. They met at the 502 Club, and they carpooled to my hospital to come in and hug me and tell me it's going to be okay. They were the last thing I saw and the first thing I saw after the surgery, and they were there. They signed up to bring meals to my family and I. They showed up every day. One of them claimed my house until I could recover enough to take back. This program has told me, they told me on one of my first days in it, that my worst day was behind me, which I thought was baloney. Again, I said the good word. That I thought it was baloney. And it wasn't. My worst day is behind me, not because my life is easy or gotten better, but because how I approach what happens to me is different. You've given me tools to look at things differently, and that is what I'm totally grateful for. So, I recovered from that surgery. The cancer was completely eradicated, and I am forever grateful for that. But you see, I'm an Al-Anon, and I'm lying to you. So you know that hole in my gut? That wasn't cancer. That was something worse. That was something that could kill me faster than cancer. And that was my own denial. And so what I did is, they give you lots of medicine. I've had big surgeries. I have lots of pain medicine. I don't like pain medicine. I am not against pain medicine, but there's a lack of control when I'm on it, so I don't do it. I'd rather have pain than be out of control. But I kept it. And I'll tell you why. I kept it because in that empty place in my gut, I knew there was going to be a day. And there came a day shortly after that, and you know, I believe in being honest. I had about 13, 14 years in the program at that point. And I asked my friend to watch my children, and I went to the bathroom. I went to the bathroom with all those pills and a glass of water because I was done. I was done trying to figure it out. I couldn't figure it out. I was embarrassed to tell you because I've got 13, 14 years in this program. Shouldn't I know this? You're going to look at me like, what are you doing wrong? So I was done, and I had those pills, and I had the phone. Now, I'm not quite sure why I had the phone, but I believe God put the phone in there. And the phone rang, and I answered it. Now, I don't know why you answer the phone if you're going to kill yourself. You know, in my sick little mind, what if it's someone who needs help? Yeah, right, like you're in a position, right? And so I answered the phone, and it was a member of Al-Anon. And she said, what are you doing, precious? And because I really didn't want to die, I told her what I was doing. And she said, this is what you're going to do. She said, you're going to flush him down the toilet. You're going to call your husband and tell him to get home now. I don't care if you tell him the house is on fire. You get home and you go to your meeting tonight. And you're going to tell three people there what you were planning to do today. And don't make any of them newcomers. You'll scare them. So I went to my meeting that night, and I did tell three people what I was going to do. One of them was my sponsor, and one of them was my friend Denise, and she still has PTSD. She goes, oh, God, I couldn't believe you told me that. And to this day, I'm like, dude, it was a long time ago. But anyway, I don't remember who the third one was, but I do remember when I told my sponsor, she looked at me, and she didn't look at me with disgust. She looked at me with the love that you've taught us to show each other in this program, and she said, honey, we got some work to do. And as a result of doing that work, I chose to leave that marriage. I'm not here to take anyone's inventory. I just couldn't do the ride anymore. Even though this gentleman was sober, and he still is today, he's got almost 44 years of sobriety. And I couldn't ride that ride any longer because it was making me sick and I was dying. And so I chose to leave that relationship. I am happy to report I did not get married right away. I didn't even start dating right away. So I'm like pretty proud of that. And but I did meet somebody after a while. And he was a member of this program, Al-Anon. And we dated. We actually dated. And then he actually asked me to marry him. He didn't just say, let's play a joke on somebody, because I'd never been proposed to. Even that last husband, he never proposed to me. We were getting ready to go to Hawaii, and he said, hey, while we're there, we'll get married. That was my proposal. And this man got on a knee, and he asked me. You know, I didn't expect that. I sell myself short. If you say to me, oh, do you want him to get on his knee? I would have said, oh, no, no, it doesn't matter. Yes, it does matter, because we're worthy. We're worthy of that kindness and that. And I have to treat him the same way. Sometimes that's not very easy. But, you know, we have been married now for over 23 years. We've been together 24 years. You know, I think mentally, two weeks ago, I filed for divorce Friday five times because we have decided to really test our program, and we are renovating our kitchen to the studs. And we are both A-type personalities, so this is going just grand. And, you know, I thought it. I didn't do it because, you know, you've taught me. If it's in here, it's okay. Don't let it come out there, so it hasn't yet. And I'm grateful to be here this weekend because he's doing a few things and around the house. But you know what? You've taught me to walk like I talk. When I'm here with you now, I want to be current because I don't want that hole in my stomach. I don't want to lie to you. I'm not here to, it's not a popularity contest. This is a way of life for me. This is beyond my wildest dreams. I am so grateful for the people that show up. We support each other. We're of service. I can't tell you the service work we've done and talked each other into doing. And all of us. And we've traveled places and done things. But you know what? It's not for you. It's for us. Because I am so grateful that you even want someone like me here. This is a long way from a bathroom where I was getting beat up on the outside. But you know what? If you stick around and if you're new or fairly new, this is beyond your wildest dreams. All dreams come true. They just come true in their own way in different packages. And my son has gifted me and with Lillian, my beautiful grandbaby. And she is an absolute delight. I love her. He lives in Eureka, California, and we were living in Southern California. My stepfather passed away, and they live up in Yuba City. I'm learning to call that home, folks. This is a hard stretch for me. So, Yuba City. Oh, God, please, no one there buy the tape. But anyway. So, we had an opportunity. My mother was going to lose her home. And my mother is 84 years old. She was going to lose her home. She was going to come live with us in Southern California. And I had this bright idea. Why don't we buy her home? You know, we'll buy her home. And, you know, we'll go there. You know, I can work remotely. My husband can work remotely. And his daughter lives in Sacramento. And it's closer to the grandbaby. And my husband is a hard, fast Southern California person. I mean, he was born and raised here. And he didn't want to. And he said, okay. And we moved up there. And it's farm country, which is a little bit different than Southern California. And I have to tell you, if you really want to test your time in the program, move somewhere where they don't know you and go to meetings. It's an interesting thing. I decided I wanted to get right into the program up there. They have two meetings a week. And I was going. So I walked in one night, and there was three people there, and I know for sure two of them didn't like me. And I walked in, and the one older man looked at me. I don't even know why he said it. He goes, "Are you an Amias?" And I thought, what the hecky-decky? Again, did not say the bad word. What's he talking about? Am I an Amias? And then I thought about it. I thought, oh, my God, he means Amias. He means Amias. And I said, oh, you mean Amias. He goes, oh, no. It's Amias. Okay, so be it. And so I took my seat there, and they would pass a collection and the seventh tradition. And I asked one night, because silly me, because I'd been there for a little while, several months, and no one did a treasurer's report. And I said, do we do contributions? Do we do treasurer's report? And the other woman, who did not like me, looked at me and said, honey, you're in our neck of the woods now. We do it our way. So I left the meeting after the meeting. And I called my grand sponsor, Betty Ann, and I ratted her out because I needed backup. And Betty Ann promised me she was going to send the Reno girls down. I guess we were going to take them out in the parking lot or something. She didn't do that, but she promised me, and I felt better. I thought, yeah, we're going to come get you guys. So, but she also told me I couldn't give up my seat. And so I kept going to that meeting. And that meeting is now about 30 people. Now, it's not because of me, but I kept going. And the gift was for me. And the one lady who told me I was in her neck of the woods, one day she walked up to me to ask me a question. And I don't know where this came from other than the God of my understanding. And she was talking to me about something. She was giving me directions, actually. You better be here. You better do it. And I thought, I was just looking at her. And all of a sudden, I looked at her and I said, I love you. And she said, I love you too. These are gifts of the program that I miss if I walk away too soon and I get my resentment and I take it home and just fester it and let it just consume me. And I love that lady. And I go to meetings with her now. And I can't wait to see her. They still do it wrong, but I can't wait to see her. And the funny thing is that gentleman, the next meeting I went to, he brought me in this piece of paper that phonetically spelled out Amias to tell me how it was really Amias. I'm thinking, dude, you got control issues. I mean, he brought me a piece of paper so I could phonetically say it. I said, you got it. It's Amias to you. But no, I'm still not one. And so I go to the meetings up there. I got to be of service to my mother. You know, my mother's going to be 85 next year. I mean, next year, yeah, 10 years from now, I am too. No, not really. But my mother's going to be next month. She's going to be 85. And 3.5 years ago, she had open heart surgery. And she almost didn't make it. It was a really tough deal. And we knew that she could not live alone. And so the moving up here was a gift for all of us. I get to spend more time with her. Sometimes I like the gift better than others because we are there 24/7. And but, you know, I know it is a gift. I try to treat her with the kindness and respect she deserves. She's failing. She can't walk. I don't know what happened after her surgery, but her legs don't work very well. And for some reason, it's just a progressive thing for her. And it's getting harder and harder for her to walk. And she's very resistant of that because her mind is sharp. My father, not so much. But her, she's very sharp. And she doesn't want to have a walker. She doesn't want to have a wheelchair. She doesn't, but I don't want her to fall. So we have conversations. We have meetings. And I say, Mom, here you have choices. You don't want to use it, that's your choice. I support that. You fall, you break your hip, you go to, you're going to be in an assisted living nursing home, and that's all I can do. It's not a threat. It's your reality. I cannot physically take care of you. So we have, you know, we have an agreement. I allow her to be her. I allow her to do what she can do. I want to control it because I'm selfish. I want her longer. You know, my father moved. My father has a home, and we get to share it with him in New York. And it's a family home. It's been in the family for a long time. It's on a beautiful lake up there. And we usually go for 4th of July, and we see him. And, you know, there's a challenge there because I have a stepmother who, that's another story. We need another hour, but we won't do that. And he's forgetful. But it's only forgetful when he's on the medication she gives him. When we took him off the medication last year when we were there, it was amazing how sharp he got. And so we've had some challenges there. And this, I like to see him every year, and I'll call him. And I say, hey, Dad. And he goes, and he always calls me Rob Sue. Hey, Rob Sue. You know, and I say, how you doing? Oh, I'm doing good. What are you doing? Watching TV. He's always watching TV. Sitting in his chair watching TV. And at the end, I always tell him, Dad, don't forget me. He says, I won't. I won't, baby girl. Don't worry about it. And that's a gift. That's all I want from him. I don't care about anything else. I care about the love. I just want to say that, you know, today I'm here, and I hope that you're getting what you need this weekend. I hope your cup is full and overflowing when you leave here today. Mine is. I will drive home to Yuba City later on today. And I will do my best to be a member of this program in good standing like you've taught me to do. Thank you for being here. Thank you for participating in my recovery today. I don't know what it's done for you, but for me, it's made my life just the best ever. So, Lynn, I love you. You are just, and Maureen, you know, if you don't have a sponsor, get a good one. But you can't have that one, okay? I'm just saying, because I need access. But thank you for being here. And Patrick, thank you so much for just being the host of hostess. And Sarah, too, wherever. I love you guys. Thank you.